tangi chu tang so ki cho nam na jang chu bar du da mi kya su ji da gi jin so gi pi so nam gi dro la pen chi sang gi dru par sho. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened.
To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtues merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness.
May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss, which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands.
Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratna Mandala Uddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samaye. Okay, welcome. Clarifying the sage's intent. We had a little logistical pause there for a couple of weeks since our last session. But just to pick up where we left off, last class we did the students' due diligence of establishing the validity of the teacher, and we went through Sakyapandita's resume, so to speak, to qualify him as a teacher, and in fact one of the great minds I think that ever walked on the earth. And then we did due diligence on the text itself, and we talked about the original origin of the original quotation was from Maitreya, the future Buddha, and sage's intent is just a commentary on two verses of the 20th chapter of a large text from Maitreya, one of the Maitreya texts. Then we went through the Sanskrit title and the Tibetan title, which plants seeds in our consciousness so that when Maitreya comes, we'll be able to understand directly. And that's a tradition. And also we went through the Sakyapandita's pledge of composition, which is another traditional aspect of texts where the author basically tells you what he's going to tell you. What Sakyapandita did is he condensed 10 topics that Maitreya had in his text, and he condensed them to 7, which are recognizing the spiritual potential, appreciating the Dharma, generating the thought of awakening, accomplishing the 6 perfections, the 4 means to bring beings to spiritual maturity, entering the noble path of the Arya levels of the Bhumis, and explaining the result of Buddhahood, which has 3 subtopics: non-situated nirvana, highest awakening, and the display of the Buddha's deeds. That's a very quick summary of what we covered last time to bring us to the actual beginning of the text, Sakyapandita's text. The text itself, in general, is basically a roadmap to enlightenment. From before becoming a Buddhist, doing practice, attaining enlightenment, and then doing the activities of a Buddhist. It's like a spiritual GPS. So that tells you, you know, where you've been and where you're going and where the curves in the road are, how not to get sidetracked into practices that will lead you into either lower rebirths or unfavorable higher rebirths, like the form and formless realms. And that actually we're exactly where we want to be. We have our precious human rebirth. And this text gives us a map so that we can stay on track and develop spiritually with Mahayana motivation, of course. It's a Mahayana text, a great vehicle text. I'm really in love with this text because this was the text for the first year of study of the Complete Path program. And for me personally, it was a real eye-opener. This text really refined and improved my practice dramatically. So this is a text that I think is really helpful. It was written by Sakyapandita for the average person, and he went around from town to town and village to village and taught it to anybody and everybody. It was actually the teaching that he gave the most. And it's the tradition that when a new Sakyatrizin is enthroned, this is the first teaching that they give. That's some background on this particular text. Now, the first topic is spiritual potential. And this is another way of translating what is sometimes translated as Buddha nature. But Sakyapandita goes into it a little bit more detail, and he distinguishes two types, natural and developed. Natural spiritual potential is what all sentient beings have. It's, from insects, animals, humans, spirits, any sentient being has it. It's underneath all of our negativity and defilements and obscurations. That's what you'll find there. The reason we're not Buddhas, or we haven't realized Buddhahood, is we have all this gunk, this stuff, this negativity on top of it. But really, Buddhahood is not something out there or that we have to go get or buy or find. It's our natural state. We just don't recognize it. Natural propensity is sometimes called the support, or what Sakyapandita calls the support, and developed potential is the supported. So if it helps you to understand it in that terminology, those are words that he also uses. As always, we're using words, and we're using translations, and we're using language, and so we need to remember that and recognize that. It's helpful, but it's not always perfect. And so there's lots of debates around terminology and vocabulary and translations and so on and so forth. Not being a translator and not being a Sanskrit expert and not being a Tibetan expert, I leave that discussion to those folks. But for us, these two categories distinguishes basically somebody who's not on the path yet, is not a Mahayana practitioner yet, and somebody who is. In Sakyapandita's text, he goes into somewhat of a discussion about the view of Yogacharya versus the view of Madhyamaka, and what school believes what, and what terminology they use, and what distinctions they make, and so on and so forth. I don't think we're going to go into that tonight. If you're interested in that sort of discussion, you know, there's plenty of discussion there you can read about. But basically, we all sentient beings have a potential for becoming a Buddha, but not all of us actually get on the path. And so this text is going to be a discussion about how do we do that. It's kind of a sentient being's owner's manual. Yeah. And it's good because then you can reference it. You know, you can look it up. So we'll be going into those seven topics about how do you actually become a Buddha and get enlightened and then help others, of course. We're not going to talk very much about natural propensity. We're going to talk about developed propensity. How do we distinguish that? Sakyapandita list four marks of spiritual potential of the Mahayana. So the first one is great compassion. Now, remember, we're talking about potential here. We're not on the path yet. But there are some people who are just naturally compassionate, or some beings that are naturally compassionate. And when he says great compassion, we need to be careful not to confuse that with the great compassion of the Buddhas. Because when that term is used in regard to Buddhists, it means their compassion is without distinction. They have compassion for all beings. And that's what makes it great. We, most of us, don't have compassion for all beings. We have sort of limited versions of that. But in this case, the great compassion means somebody who's just naturally compassionate a lot. And you probably know people like that, you know, people that are just really nice people and have kind of a good sense of compassion, and they're not Buddhists. They just have that tendency or that propensity. So these are sort of like the prerequisites, so to speak, of before you get on the path, is great compassion. And then the second one is appreciation for the three jewels, which is a natural, spontaneous appreciation for Mahayana teachings. And again, it's not really developed, but, you know, loving kindness, compassion, altruism, mindfulness, you know, these principles that we have in Mahayana, there are people who have an appreciation for that, just, we say, naturally, but it's a propensity that they've developed through their lifetimes, even though they're not on what we would call the Mahayana path yet. You can see that they have tendencies in that direction. The third one is listed as great forbearance, and that just simply means having patience for whatever harm comes your way. Again, I think if you look around, you probably see that there are some people that are really patient. They're just, that's their character, that's their makeup, you know. My sister was like that. She was not a Buddhist, but she had so much suffering and pain and health problems, and from the moment she was born to the moment she died, it was unbelievable. I mean, it was just incredible to watch her forbearance, her patience. You know, I came from a big family, and all of us were just in awe of her, and we all said, boy, I couldn't do that, you know. But there are some people that are just made that way, so to speak, or their propensity is that. And then the fourth one is wanting to put effort into the practice of the six perfections. Now, we've talked a lot about the six perfections in the past, so we don't really need to go into that now, and we're going to talk about it even more later. Again, this doesn't mean that the person is actually practicing the six perfections because they're not on the Mahayana path yet, but they have that propensity, they have generosity, they have morality, they have patience, and so on. So their practice is actually similar to what we would call a Mahayana practice. And again, we're going to talk about what qualifies a practice as a perfection. And we might be surprised what we see there. So these are the signs of somebody who has this potential. Sakyapandita says, whoever has these four signs displays Buddha potential. So they actually display it, they show it, you can see it, you know, in their behavior. On the other hand, there are four impediments to spiritual potential that Sakyapandita lists. The first one being habituation to mental afflictions. Now this can be a craving or an aversion. And it could be to just about anything. It could be food, it could be wealth, it could be other people. It's an excessive habituation to the affliction and being under the power of it. You know, it's like an obsession that somebody has, or a fixation, or towards a defilement. Either for or away from. You're either really, really, you know, attracted to something, or you're really have aversion to it. So either way, and those afflictions drive our actions and our emotions. So if we have an obsession about something or we have an aversion to something, it sort of takes over our behavior. And Ape Rinpoche says that it really boils down to the three poisons: desire, anger, and ignorance. And when a person is under those kind of influences, the thought of Dharma practice just simply doesn't arise. The person is just so driven by that, it kind of overcomes them in a way that prevents them from an inclination to practice. So that's an impediment, the first impediment. The second impediment the Sakyapandita lists is being under the influence of bad friends and or bad teachers. Obviously, harmful friends can influence us in negative ways, and I think probably all of us have either personally experienced that or we've seen it happen where somebody gets in the wrong crowd and you end up going along with the group and end up doing things that are not necessarily the best choice. If you're a person that's in that situation or you're susceptible to those kind of situations, you know, social pressure and so on, I mean, we are social animals, and you get caught up in the wrong crowd, so to speak, that can really take you to a place that's an impediment to your spiritual potential. And that includes bad teachers, family. It doesn't just have to be a gang. It could be your best friend. And it's anybody or any situation that says, oh, you don't want to go to that Dharma talk. Let's go to the beach tonight. It's beautiful out, you know. Or you don't believe in that stuff, do you? Really? You believe in reincarnation? Or whatever. It could be somebody that's really close to you that's pushing you away from your spiritual potential and for practicing it. They're jeopardizing your practice, basically. And if a person does that, they are known as a harmful friend. And by the way, included in this category is laziness. So it doesn't have to be a person. It could be your own laziness. And as we've talked about on several occasions, laziness has different presentations. It isn't just, oh, I don't feel like doing it. It could also be, I'm too busy to do it. I'm busy. Oh, I'd really like to practice, but I have so many things to do. That falls in this category of harmful influence, even though it's ourselves influencing ourselves. Another kind of laziness is low spiritual self-esteem. Oh, I couldn't do that. I could never become a Buddha. I could never do those practices. I'm just not, that's just another kind of ego, really. That's a kind of laziness that also falls into this category. The third impediment that Sakyapandita lists is lacking adequate food, shelter, clothing, or other basic necessities. Obviously, if a person is in a situation where their main thought is their next meal and where it's going to come from, or if they don't have enough clothes to protect them from the environment and the weather and so on, or whatever, that overrides their ability to think in spiritual terms and spiritual practice. Most people, if you're in that situation, that's your reality, and that's going to impede your ability to not only practice, but to make offerings, or to maybe travel to go see a teacher or teaching or something like that. So if you're in, you know, severe poverty, that's an impediment. It's not impossible to overcome, but we're speaking generally here. Also, being too busy falls under the category of poverty. So you may not be worrying about your next meal, but you may be so busy because you're working three jobs or whatever. You know, you've gone to the extreme of being a workaholic. Lamas say, don't be a workaholic. The fourth category is being under the control of others. Now, this could be a family situation where you have a really dominant family situation and they're inhibiting your life or your lifestyle. They're obliging you to be somebody or participate in the family in a certain situation or a certain way, which you are under their control and you don't really have your freedom. There's certain cultures, certain societies where the family is everything and you really have to sort of submit yourself to family will, so to speak. There are situations like that. It could be the government. It could be under the control of a repressive government that inhibits your ability to receive teachings and practice Dharma. Lots of situations like that around the world these days. You could be in prison. Your freedom could be inhibited dramatically in a situation of prison. Or you could be distracted by objects, people, or devices. Yeah. So those things fall under this category too, where you're under the control of something or somebody which takes you off the path or prevents you from going on to the path. Those are the four categories listed there for impediments. And then Sakyapandita goes into a discussion about what he calls severed spiritual potential. And there's four categories there as well, interestingly enough. And a sub-discussion of this is temporarily severed potential and permanently severed potential. So we'll go through the categories first of all. The first one is a severed spiritual potential, which comes from a lack of virtue conducive to gaining liberation. So virtue is another word for merit. In other words, the person lacks merit. Merit, of course, comes from previous lifetimes, activities, hopefully. And if you haven't done enough merit accumulation previously, you won't have enough potential. You have the potential, but it's been severed in this discussion. Severed in the sense that you really just don't have enough. And actually, we talked last week a little bit about how it takes really lots and lots of merit to even hear the word Buddha, let alone come across a text like this and have commentaries and understanding of it. So we should really not underestimate how much merit we have accumulated just to know this or to be in this discussion. Lots of beings don't have that kind of merit. They haven't accumulated merit, and so their potential is severed. The second category in severed potential is those who have committed the five heinous crimes or deeds or very serious negative actions. So killing your father, killing your mother, killing an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha, and causing a division in the Sangha. Those are very, very serious transgressions. And there are other very serious transgressions too. And if you commit one of those, you have what's called severed spiritual potential. It's a very, very bad karmic situation to be in. And they're called the sins of immediate retribution because when you die, generally speaking, people go to bardo or an intermediate state. If you have committed one of those crimes, you don't even go to there. You just go straight down to a hell realm. The third category is those who have destroyed the seeds of good factors by holding wrong views. In that case, holding a wrong view would be not believing in the law of karma, not believing in the three jewels, just having a basic rejection of what we would call basic Buddhist principles or beliefs. There are some people that just absolutely don't want to hear it, don't believe in it, and they have kind of a closed door attitude about it. They've destroyed their seeds of virtue so that they're in a situation where they just don't want to hear it, don't want to believe about it. They just are not open to it, basically. You probably run into people like that. Sometimes they're just absolutely closed-minded about it. That's a severed spiritual potential. And then the fourth one is those whose seeds of good factors have not been germinated and ripened by the moisture of virtue. Those are Sakyapandita's words. I like that phrase, the moisture of virtue. One way of talking about spiritual potential is that it's a seed. But like any seed, and for it to grow, it has to be nurtured, it has to be watered and taken care of. And how do we do that? By generating merit, by doing practice. And if a person or a being is in that situation where they haven't really ripened their seed, they are unable to receive teachings. They just don't get it. They no matter how much exposure they have to Dharma or teachings or Mahayana path, they either don't get it or they don't want to get it. They just don't want to hear it. They just are closed. The door is closed. As a result of that, they aren't able to tame their mind and improve their mind along the path that we're talking about here. They haven't destroyed their merit, but they haven't cultivated it. So those are the four categories of severed spiritual potential. Now, there's a discussion in the text about is it temporary or is it permanent? Without going into it too much, the Yogacharya school believes that it is possible to permanently sever your potential. Whereas, no, it's not really permanent, but they also say that samsara will never end. And Ape Rinpoche in his book says, well, if you say samsara is never going to end, you're saying, in effect, that some beings are permanently severed and they're not going to get out of it. Otherwise, at some point, samsara would end. So these are discussions that you can get into if you want to. But basically, anybody that's in any of these categories is in a rough state. Later on, we're going to talk about how to help people or how to help beings. But that's another discussion in the text later on. To illustrate a couple of examples that we've just discussed, we have a couple of stories that are in Ape Rinpoche's book. One is a story about what can happen if you get caught up with a teacher who's not really a good teacher, who influences you in a way that's negative. There'll be a story about that. And there's another story about this fourth category, somebody that just doesn't want to have anything to do with Dharma. We've got an excellent reader here that's going to read our stories for us, so save my voice and you'll hear these stories.
There are two stories to illustrate the point about the difficulty of awakening Buddha nature. The first concerns Alguli Mala, whose name means the one who wears the garland of fingers. These events occurred when Buddha Shakyamuni was residing in Shravasti. At that time, there was a great scholar living there who had a great many disciples. One day, the king summoned his scholar to his palace, and before setting off on his journey, the scholar left behind one of his main disciples to guard his house and keep watch over his wife. At that time, this disciple was known as the one who was pleasing to look at, because he was extremely handsome. Indeed, he was so good-looking that the scholar's wife became very attracted to him. In fact, When her husband and his other students had left, she approached the disciple in a very provocative manner. But the disciple refused to have anything to do with her. He explained that he thought of her as a mother, and then ran away to escape her advances. The scholar's wife was mortified by this rejection, so she devised a plan to take revenge on the boy. She ripped her clothes to shreds, scratched her entire body, and beat herself with a stick. When her husband returned, she told him that his young disciple had attacked her during his absence. The scholar believed his wife's story and decided to punish the boy by ruining his life. However, as this student was very clever, the teacher knew he would need to use considerable cunning. So he told the boy that he had forfeited his Brahmin caste because of his bad behavior. Furthermore, he said that unless he regained his status by killing 1,000 human beings, he would never be able to attain liberation or be reborn in the heavenly realms. At first, the boy refused, because he could not believe it would be right to kill people. However, by explaining that he must heed the words of his teacher, who was instructing him in the correct understanding of the world's ways, his teacher eventually convinced him. Having finally accepted his teacher's advice, the student set about his task. When he had succeeded in killing 1,000 people, he reported back to his teacher. But the master told him he needed to produce proof of these killings. He told him he should cut a finger from the hand of each of the people he'd killed, string these fingers together to make a garland, and wear the garland around his neck. He would therefore have to kill another 1,000 people in order to collect the proof. So the boy set out again. Because of the necklace of fingers around his neck, he acquired the name Angulimala. At the time when he had succeeded in killing a further 999 people, Angulimala saw his mother, who had become alarmed by his long absence and had left her house to search for him. When the boy saw his mother approaching, he decided to kill her. This would both complete the goal of 1,000 victims and enable him to gain the state of rebirth in a heavenly realm. Furthermore, by killing his mother, he reasoned, he would be placing her into a heavenly realm also. With such thoughts in mind, he drew out his knife and began to approach her. Through his omniscience, Buddha Shakyamuni perceived what was happening. He saw that this was the right moment to awaken the boy and place him on the path to cessation. So Buddha began to walk towards him. The boy noticed the wondrous figure of Buddha coming his way and called out to him to stop. He asked Buddha who he was and why did he have the audacity to walk towards him like that. Buddha replied that he was fully awakened. He was the fully awakened one. He continued approaching. Angulimala shouted out to Buddha that he would kill him unless he stopped. Buddha replied that he was actually standing still, not moving at all. He said that he always remained still in a place where no one would ever harm anyone. Angulimala should also abide in that place where he would have the patience never to harm another living being. Buddha explained to Angulimala that he had allowed himself to be completely misled to the point of wanting to kill his own mother, who with great kindness and compassion had come to help him. He told Angulimala he had been tricked into following a false path, which would lead only to enormous suffering. Thus Buddha tamed Angulimala's mind and convinced him he was on the wrong path. Upon hearing these words, Angulimala there and then took refuge in the Buddha and requested ordination, and Buddha agreed. And Angulimala was ordained
and through Buddha's teachings, which had awakened his seed of virtue, Angulimala would later attain arhatship within that same lifetime.
Okay, thank you. So that's a very famous story from a sutra. You might say, well, that's really extreme. But the fact of the matter remains that it is possible to be misled by a teacher. And I think especially these days, with social media and the internet and all the books that are out there and videos and everything, there's a lot of teachers, and some of them, it's not that necessarily they have bad intentions, but they may not be the teacher to lead you to the enlightenment of Mahayana. And that's why last class we did this process of validating the teacher and the teaching. And that's I think the lesson is to check it out. Check out your teacher, make sure that they're qualified and that they're in harmony with where you want to be. So even though that's an extreme example, that story, it's still something that we ourselves need to pay attention to, I think. And then there's another story around the person that just simply doesn't want to hear it, doesn't want to hear Dharma.
The second story is about a young Chinese boy whose family one day decided to send him to a temple which housed many holy images, including statues of the Buddha and the Buddha's Zarfa, Alokiteshvara. He was told to study these images closely and learn to identify them. However, he didn't want to. In fact, he felt strong aversion towards all holy images. So before entering the temple, he put on a blindfold to make sure he would not catch even a glimpse of any of the images. No matter how much his parents urged him, he flatly refused to look at them. Later on, his parents thought of a plan to get around their son's obstinacy. They tried placing an image of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara inside a vessel, which they covered and placed before him. Without telling him what it contained, they instructed him to open the vessel and look at the image inside it. However, their son was suspicious and became annoyed. He wrapped a length of cloth around his eyes and ears so that he would not be able either to see or to hear. Wrapping another cloth around his hands, he picked up the vessel and threw it away. This story is another illustration of how difficult it is for us to awaken our race.
Race there refers to Mahayana, great vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't refer to skin or anything
yeah,
like
well,
that.
Well, and the paragraph that we touched on before
yeah.
explains that really clearly, if I may.
Yeah.
With regard to the etymology of the term Buddha nature, spiritual propensity, or race, the Sanskrit word is gotra. With respect to the first syllable of this word go, if we change the O to U and add na, we have the word guna, which means excellent qualities. Then with the second syllable, if we divide the syllable tra into its components, the result is tara, which means liberating. Therefore, as one is liberated on the basis of excellent qualities, Buddha nature or spiritual propensity may be described as the excellent liberating quality.
So, as we mentioned last time, one of Sakyapandita's characteristics is he was born fluent in Sanskrit. So throughout his text he has these Sanskrit lessons about various grammar and so forth in Sanskrit. But he was able to read directly the scriptures without having to worry about a translator doing it. And so he was also able to communicate with, they were actually refugees from India who ended up in Tibet because Buddhism was being obliterated in India. And so Sakyapandita, from a very early age, had contact with great Indian masters who he conversed with in Sanskrit. Pretty amazing. He was the first Tibetan to write a text in Tibetan and have it translated in India in Sanskrit and taught in India. And he was the first Tibetan to be given the title Pandito. We talked about that last time, the five major and the five minor sciences. So he was quite a figure, historical figure, Sakyapandita. So that is the first chapter in Sakyapandita's text on spiritual propensity. Any questions about that? I think it's good to know this, to know the before refuge phase, because next chapter we're going to talk about refuge. Now, refuge is something that we say every time we do a practice, we say refuge prayer. It's something we kind of take for granted, but we're going to see next time that taking refuge is actually a fairly complicated topic, and it's good to really understand it so that your refuge can be stronger and can be better, so to speak. So that's something that's coming up. But I think this lesson prepares us for that because it shows us the before refuge step, which is crucial in becoming a Mahayana practitioner. And at the end of every practice, we do dedication of merit. So now we'll do the dedication of merit. Thank you for your reading, by the way. So nam de tan jazu pani tob nam ye pe danam pam jete ge ga na chi banum tu pe Sit pe tso le do wa do wa sho Jang chu zem chu rin po che Ma ke pa nam ke dur che Ke ma nyam pa ne par yang Gong ne gong tu pel par sho Jam pa pa oi ji tar ken pa dang Gun du sang po de yang de shin te De da kung gi je su da lo che Ge wa di da tam je ra tu no Tu sung je bi gya wa tam je gi No wa gang wa chu tu nga pa gi Dak shen ge we za wa di kung kyang San po chu je ma du no Chak sa wa dang cho jin cha pa dang Je su yi rung gu jin so wa yi Ge wa chung de da gi jin sa pa Tong je zo pe jang chu che By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings and Humitasanta risen, may it never decline, where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way Valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra, know how to transfer merit. So do I dedicate all of my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings,
dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
JJ.